Our special guest is Bruce Coville, and he's the author of many well-loved books. I know some of you have read the stuff that we have here at the library, such as the Magic Shop series, or My Teacher's an Alien, or I saw some people brought their Unicorn Chronicles with them. And he's also the founder of Fullcast Audio for family listeners. So please join me in welcoming Bruce Coville.
Thank you. I love when people clap before I start. If I mess up, I still have my applause. It's very important. We're going to talk about the 90s books and where they come from. How the idea for a story gets inside my little bald head. What I do that once it's in there to get it on paper. Once it's on paper, what still has to happen before it's a finished book that can be shared with folks like you. And to do that, what I want to do is tell you one specific story came from, because it's almost always better to be specific than general, generally speaking. The story I'm going to tell you about tonight is called The Monster's Ring. I'm not sure how many of you know it. I know a lot of you have got it, so you're going to know it sooner or later. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you a little bit of the story, so you all know what we're talking about. Then I'm going to tell you the story behind the story, where it came from, how it grew, how it became a book. Now, before we get started, a couple of bits of what I call housekeeping, how we're going to do the evening together. First is the man of questions. Questions are very important. After all, you know better than I know what you want to know, if you know what I mean. But I'm going to ask you to hold those questions until the end. Because if we keep stopping and making through this, and I have a certain order I want to go in, I might be going to tell you what you want to know in 5 minutes anyways. But at the end, I'll leave time for questions. Second, I have to ask you to listen very carefully. For two or three reasons. One, it's a fairly large room. And two, I have a speech problem. I've had it all my life. I work very hard to conquer it. But the fact is it almost always gets away from me during the course of a presentation. The problem is, as you have probably begun to realize, I tend to speak very rapidly. The thing is, the more excited I get, the faster I talk. And I do get excited about books because they're my favorite things, especially my own books. Instead of talking faster, for instance, the words start to cram together. Now, that's what starts to happen. It's actually not such a big problem here in New York, but when I go down south, it really we call it Yankee disease down there. Three things you can do. First, listen more carefully. You can actually hear faster than you think you can. That's because you are smarter than you think you are, which I'm going to try to prove to you later on. Second, if it gets real bad, roll your eyes at me. If I see 5 or 10 kids with their eyes go around in circles, I'll know I'm talking too fast. If it's real, real bad, Julia, you crawl over, bite any ankle, and I'll slow down, okay? The Monster's Ring is about a kid named Russell Kraniker who's having problems with a bully named Eddie. On the day the story begins, Eddie has poked him, Eddie has punched him, Eddie has called him names, Eddie has smushed him in the face with a cream-filled cupcake. Russell's not happy, who would be? After school that day, standing in the alleyway next to the drugstore in the small town, very small town where he lives, a little place called Kennethuck Falls. And he's imagining, because it is October, so Halloween's coming, he's got monsters on the brain, and because he's so upset about Eddie, he's imagining that he, Russell, could be Frankenstein's monster. You guys all seen the old Boris Karloff Frankenstein movie, or the Frankenstein walk, arms up, head back, and go, he's doing that down the alley. It's just goofy, you know, he's gonna go, wouldn't it be Frankenstein's monster? And get Eddie. And he imagines Eddie in front of him, begging for mercy, pleading, growling. Oh, man, he can just hear Eddie's voice. He can hear Eddie's voice. He can hear Eddie's voice. He opens his eyes, and there's Eddie right there in front of him. And there's a look on his face that Russell knows very well. It's the look that means it's cream of Russell soup time. So Russell does the only thing that makes sense to him at this point. It's like he runs for his life. At the end of the alleyway, he gets a garbage can for leverage as he makes the corner. The can falls over, Eddie's right behind him, slips in the slop and falls on his can. Russell knows he's really in trouble now, runs even faster, turns another corner, another corner, another corner, and finds himself on a street he's never seen before. And this bothers him because he's lived in this town all of his life, and it is not big enough to get lost in. It's late afternoon, so it's getting dark. There's a fog rising. The mist curls around his feet like, sort of like snakes made out of smoke. He walks on. At the end of the street, he sees a strange, old-fashioned looking shop. In the window of the shop are these words. Can you all see that? Now, the reason I wrote this down is because people very often ask me how you pronounce the name of the shop or the name of the man who owns the shop. And you may know this shop because it appears in 5 books. There are all 5 out there. This is the first book, Monster's Ring, where it appeared. But but it's in 5 and R. And the clue to the pronunciation is actually in the name. I pronounce it, because the shop is run by a man, it's Mr., and I pronounce it Elives, because that makes him Mr. Elives, which makes him Mr. Elives, which makes him Mr. Elives, which makes him Mr. Elives. Mr. Elives, Mr. Elives. Now, Russell loves magic. Especially in October, it seems like anything can happen. Circus inside. A small bell rings overhead, but the shop seems to be deserted. He doesn't care because it's filled with such cool stuff. There's all sorts of magician's paraphernalia. There's long black capes like magicians wear, top hats like they have for pulling things out, and there's a whole wall full of cases of things too far to pass. There's rabbits and doves and snakes, bats, toads, lizards. A spider the size of a dinner plate. He's not sure what that's all about. In the center of the room, there's a long wooden box for that old magician's trick of sawing somebody in half. He thinks it'd be fun to try that trick on Eddie, especially if it didn't work. Over here, he sees a long mess count, Chinese rings, silk scarves, big decks of cards, a human skull labeled the Skull of Truth. At the back of the shop, there's a long wooden counter with a dragon carved in the front. On top of the counter sits an old-fashioned brass cash register. On top of the cash register sits a stuffed owl. At least he thinks it's stuffed. Until it turns its head, looks right at him, blinks twice, and goes, woo-hoo! Woo-hoo! From the back of the shop, from beyond the beaded curtain that covers the door behind the counter, comes a voice that sounds like, a little like dead leaves, scraping along the sidewalk in the October wind.
Peace, Yuila. I know he's there.
Out shuffles an old, antique, might be a better word for this guy, whose skin has more wrinkles than Russell's laundry pile. Because he stands right in front of Russell, he's short, not Russell, black diamonds. He looks Russell right in the eye and says,
why are you here?
I don't know. I came in the ground.
No. Nobody comes in my shop just to look around. What do you need?
I don't know. I didn't even see any price.
He's got a dollar bill because he was too nervous to lunch that day because of Eddie. The old man pulls the dollar bill out of his hand and says,
that'll be fine. Stay there.
Russell feels as if his feet have frozen to the floor. He cannot move. The old man disappears back through the beaded curtain. Russell hears him back there muttering, rummaging around, cussing to himself. A few minutes later, a few hours, Russell is really not sure how much time has gone by. The old man comes back carrying a small box. He holds it out to Russell and says,
here, take this. It's what you came here to get.
Russell reaches for it. But before the old man will let go, he leans even closer, stares Russell right in the eye and whispers,
for Ishtar's sake, be careful. Take the side door. It'll get you home more quickly.
Russell scoots out the side door as if his butt was on fire. And finds himself right back in the alleyway where he started out. He can't forget how he got there. For a minute, he thinks he must have had some sort of weird dream or hallucination until he realizes he's got something in his hand. Slowly, nervously, he opens his fingers. He's holding that small box. Across the top of the box, in flaming red letters, are the words, The Monster's Ring. Now, Russell loves monsters. He has the biggest collection of monster magazines of anyone in his class. So he takes his fingernail, he slits the tape that holds the box shut, lifts the lid. Inside, there's a ring made of cheap metal. Set in the top of the ring is a green stone carved in the shape of a monster's face. It's cool. So he takes it out, slips it on his finger, feels a little chill, but not as fast as he does. Underneath the ring, there's a piece of paper, all folded up. It's kind of old and yellow and crinkles as he opens it. Across the top of the paper, there's a picture of a monster, its face leering, its arms spread out as if they're holding all the words underneath it. Directly beneath the monster's chin are these words, how to work the monster's ring. Work it? How could you work a ring? He reads on. It says, to change yourself into a hideous change yourself into a hideous monster. What kind of nonsense was that? He has sworn off that kind of garbage after he wasted $6 on those stupid x-ray spectacles he got from the back of a comic book. So he crams the directions into his pocket and he heads for home. His mother's waiting at the door. He's late. She's cranky. Russell, where have you been?
I don't know.
Well, what have you been doing? Supper's ready and you're not. Come on, hurry up. Hurry up.
Hurry up.
Hurry up! Have you heard that before? Supper's a typical Cranacker family meal. His mother, she fusses all the time. It's like a hobby there. Fuss, 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 worry, worry, worry. And his father is throwing one of his pet theories about the election and the death of civilization or something. He talks on and on. Russell just said, Russell loved his father, but trying to get a word in edgeways when Mr. Cranick was talking was like trying to stop a freight train by standing in front of me. You just can't run down. So Russell just sat there chasing peas around mashed potato mountains with his fork. Later, after he'd done his homework, done a little bit of reading, he was getting ready for bed. He'd almost forgotten about the ring. But as he was undressing, he caught on his shirt sleeve. He looked at it again. Really was cool.
Why not try?
Noise and he made a fool of himself in his own room. Well, I tried. So he takes the directions out of his pocket and he spreads them on his dresser. They said, to change yourself into a hideous monster, place the ring on the ring finger of your right hand and twist it to the left as you repeat this chant. Powers dark and powers bright, I call you now, as is my right. Unleash the magic of this ring and change me to a monstrous thing. There's more. He didn't bother me the rest. He just twisted them and said the chant. Nothing happens. His x-ray spectacles all over again, he says with a shrug. He just has to walk down the hall to brush his teeth. But as he's walking, he gets a weird sensation in his forehead. He puts his hand on it. He feels something sharp and hard. He tries to pull it off, but it won't come. He runs to the bathroom, looks in the mirror, and almost faints. Because he's got horns growing out of his forehead. Horns an inch long and getting longer. There's hair starting to sprout all over his face. He needs to shave, which is weird when you're 11 years old. Shame, he's a long burst of insulin. He says it, watching himself in the mirror, fascinated, terrified, as this transformation comes over him. His eyes go large, yellow, bloodshot. His nose spreads across his face, flatter than an old prize fighter's. Curling black fur sprouts to the back of his head. He's terrified, but he also realizes this is the most interesting thing that's ever happened to him. And he thinks, wouldn't it be cool if I could see Eddie like this? His voice. He sounds like he's been gargling with razor blades. That's because he thinks this is a dream. It's got to be a dream. And he pinches himself to prove it. Unfortunately, he does not have fingernails. He's got sharp, deadly claws. And the pain and the blood convince him he's truly awakened. Now he's really terrified. What's he going to do? How's he going to turn back? He can't let anybody see. He can't let his parents see him like this. The directions. He's got to read those directions. So he starts back to his room. But as a monster, he does not have as much self-control as when he was a kid, which isn't saying all that much. So instead of walking down the hall, he needs to start down the hall. Three steps down the hallway, this voice from downstairs shouts up, Russell, is that you? His mother. Now he has to answer because if he doesn't, she'll come upstairs to see what's going on. So he tries to calm her down.
Yes, mother, it's me.
You all right, honey? You sound a little hoarse.
I'm fine. Just got a little frog with you.
All right, dear, if you're not better in the morning, it's medicine and no arguments. All right?
Yes, mother.
Well, that's so. He continues to his room, a little more careful now. But before he can read the directions, he sees the moon shining through his window. It is as if it's tied to his heart by a silver thread. It pulls him over. He looks out into the night, all black and silver and beautiful below, and he can resist no longer. Putting one hairy paw on the sill, he leaps over and out, 15 feet down into the darkness and runs howling into the night, and a monster is loose in Kennebec Falls. And that's the end of the chapter. And of course, you always stop at a spot like that because you want to keep the reader with you. Look, I know a couple things that happen when you guys read. I know one, you tend to go to the end of the chapter. You know, as your mother says, come on, you say, yeah, I'll be right there. Let me finish the chapter. Time for bed. Get on and finish the chapter. The other thing I know is when you finish the chapter and close the book, if I don't have you hooked, if you're not dying to find out what happens next, I might not get you back because I have a lot of competition for your attention. There's family, friends, chores, homework, and the darn TV all taking you away. I want you back. So I have to grab your attention. Not just at the end of every chapter. Every page, every paragraph, every sentence. I have a motto for writing. The words came from a man named Paul O'Neill. I found them in a book. I knew they were important. I copied them onto an index card and taped it to the wall above my desk. It's been there for about 30 years. If I move, the card goes with me. It says, always grab the reader by the throat in the first paragraph. Sink your thumbs into his windpipe in the second paragraph and hold it against the wall until the
last line, but
it's sort of a violent theory of writing, but it works if you pull it off. It's not always easy to do. The first time I wrote The Monster's Ring, we don't have held your attention all that well. On the other hand, the first time I wrote The Monster's Ring, we don't have held your attention all that well because it was only 5 pages long. I thought it was going to be a picture book. Here's how it happened. In the summer of 1977, almost years ago now, I've been trying for 8 years, with no success, to be a writer of books for young readers. I write my stories, I prepare them very neatly. Does neat discount? Not the beginning. My first drafts are a mess. My second drafts are a mess. My third drafts are a mess. I crossed out, I cut up, I mark up, I rearrange, I make notes in the margins, but it was stupid, Bruce, fix it. But the one I sent to the book company, you bet that one looked good. They didn't know me. They didn't know that I was handsome, cute, and fun to hang out with. All they knew was what I sent them. Before they read even one single word, they had begun to judge me. Does this look as if it's prepared by a professional who takes pride in his work? And that's the message I wanted to send. Pride and professionalism. So I prepared very neatly. I put it in an envelope, along with another envelope that had my name, address, and some stamps on it. So they sent it back if they didn't want it. Because if you don't give them that, they don't want it. They throw it away and you never see it again. And that's not so bad these days, in the days of computers, because you print it out again. But back at that time, you had to type it over again from scratch, which was really a pain in the neck for a long story. So you give them the envelope, send it back in. You'd send it off, and you'd wait. And I mean wait. 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, which is not unusual back then. It's worse these days. If you sent the story out today, you'd be lucky if you heard by spring break if they wanted it yet. No. Now, even knowing that, I was done checking the mailbox every single day. We lived in an old farmhouse with a long driveway. I couldn't see the mailbox in the window. If I was home from my job, I'd be down 3-4 times a day going, is the mail here yet? Is the mail here yet? Is the mail here yet? Because I wanted to know about my story. Finally, one day, there'd be something in the mailbox. I know it was my story because it was the envelope I gave them to send back in. I'd run to the house, I would tear open, inside it would be my story, and on top there'd be a little note that said, sorry, we don't want it. This is called a rejection slip. It's a little piece of paper about this big. It says, and you notice, I noticed it by heart because I memorized it by accident, I saw it so many times. It says, dear author, at least they call you an author, that's nice. It doesn't say dear story. Dear author, thank you for letting us consider this story. Unfortunately, it does not suit our needs at this time. Good luck selling it somewhere else. Sincerely, the editor. That's all it says. Doesn't say what's wrong, how to make it better, what they didn't like. They didn't give you advice that your parents and your teachers do. Just thanks, but no thanks. It's very polite. They are not trying to hurt your feelings. It does! Because the story's part of it. It's come from inside of you. If it hasn't, you shouldn't be sending that to begin with. But because it has come from inside of you, well, they call it a rejection slip. I call it the ugly baby letter. Because it's like getting a letter that says, dear Mr. Cole, we've carefully examined the photographs of your child, and man, you got one ugly baby! Makes you feel the same way. You cannot let that stop. What you do is you pack it, send it off somewhere else, and go write another story. I've been doing that for about 8 years, and I was a little tired of it. That summer, the summer of 1977, I had a chance for the second time to take a 2-week summer seminar in kids' books at Syracuse University, the big school near my home, where I live in upstate New York. And this one was, not only was it a 2-week seminar in kids' books, it was in writing fantasy for kids, exactly what I wanted to do. To warm up for the class, not as a class assignment, just as I felt like doing, I sat down one morning before class and wrote this little story called Monster for a Day. And this is the seed from which the Monster Ring grew. It's not the first draft, but it's the seed, it's the beginning. Monster for a Day is about a kid who goes downstairs in his house one morning after breakfast. In the basement, he finds a monster drawing bats on the cellar wall. Kid says, hey, you can't do that. The monster turns around and goes, hear it. The kid turns into the monster. The monster turns into the kid. And the kid, who now looks like the monster, spends the entire day chasing the monster who looks like him around town trying to go, hear it. So he can turn back into himself. It was fast, it was funny, it was lively, it was stupid. Now, the reason it was stupid is that I left out or ignored the single most important aspect of the story, which is, I think, and if you think about it, I think you'll agree with me, the most important thing in the story is the character. You get the most exciting situation in the world. You get the hero, hanging by his fingers from a cliff 1,000 feet above a raging river, filled with jagged rocks like this, with razor sharp edges that will cut in half, crocodiles with jaws like this, and teeth like this, who are dying to eat him. And so he's slipping, and he's gonna fall down! To his death among those rocks and crocs. And if he's a total jerk, who cares? On the other hand, if you're writing a story about a kid who's in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, all that happens as he or she trips and drops his or her books in a puddle. If you have made me like that kid, if you've made me care about him or her, I'll be more interested in that simple situation than I will the jerk up on the cliff. Now, take some of you really like it, but then when the cliff is done, oh, baby, you really got a story. But it has to start with the character. How can you care about what happens if you don't care about who is happening to? The recipe for a story is very simple. Take somebody you like and get them in trouble. Yeah, 9 times out of 10 when I say that, I see some kid look at his best friend and go, the better the character, the worse the trouble, the better the story. With one more small rule. The character has to solve the problem by him or herself. Then you can't have their parent, their teacher, a hero from the sky float down, wave it up to one and say, oh, better, I fixed it. The character has to solve the problem, usually by making a tough choice. And once you've got that structure, a character, a problem, a solution, that's your story, and everything else is details. And writing is, in many ways, the art of choosing details. I'm going to say that again. It's the art of choosing details. And by choosing the right details, you can crank up the emotional volume and make a simple situation much more compelling. Take, for example, the kid who drops his book in a puddle. Here's a detail. It's his mother's book. Automatically worse situation, right? And when you write a story, you play a game that I call Kid in Kindergarten. Did you guys ever talk to a kid in kindergarten?
Yeah.
If you have, you know this. If you haven't recently, here's a model of any conversation in the history of the world with a kindergarten child. You tell the kindergarten child what you want them to know. Blah, 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 blah. Kindergarten child replies always,
huh? Why?
Blah, 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 blah.
I see. Why?
Blah, 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 blah.
Ah. Why?
Blah, 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 blah.
Cool. Why? Why do you smack him?
Excuse me. It's only funny because it's true. You do the same thing to yourself when you're right. You go, why, where, how, most, what, why, most of all, why? Why, for example, does mother care about the book? If she bought it at Eckert's in the corner, or, you know, Duane's, Duane Reed, for $7, she'll be mad. It's not a big deal. She'll get back in place. Bad is not enough to hang a story on. What book, you ask yourself, would have more emotional connection, more heart value, and be harder to replace? And you start to make a list. Maybe in your head, maybe on a piece of paper. A lot of my writing is on pieces of paper that are not part of the story, writing about the writing. So you go, okay, maybe it's his mother's cookbook. Yeah, that's not so hot. But your mind, once you start, your mind jumps along like a flea, boing, 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 or like a monkey singing from a tree from branch to branch to branch. So maybe it's his mother's cookbook. Maybe it's grandma's cookbook. Now you got a little time value on there, a little family value. That's good, but second, oh! What if grandma made notes in the margins about how she wrote, how she changed the recipes to make them unique for her family? That's why she always won first prize at the state fair for her chocolate chip cookies or, you know, for her pot roast. Now, that's better, because you can't go back and replace grandma's notes at Duane Reade in the corner. But, you know, the best part of that is the writing the book. Oh, oh! And your mind makes another bounce. Here's a book you write in. How about it's his mother's diary? Cool, it's a death for that one. Maybe that's just, oh, oh! Here's a book, see your mind bounces and bounces. Here's a book you write in. How about it's his mother's high school yearbook, signed by all her best friends? And you say to yourself, okay, I can work with that one. You go right back to being a kid in kindergarten. You say, why? Why is he taking his mother's yearbook to school? Because you have to do that. You have to have a reason. Sure. To answer the question, you're close. To answer the question, you invent a scene. And by asking questions and inventing scenes that answer them, you end up with the story. I'm going to say that one again. By asking questions and inventing scenes that answer them, you end up with a story. Here's the scene. Social studies class. Teacher says, we're going to start a new unit today on family history. It's time you little weasels found out where you came from. You probably don't even know your own parents' life story. Here are 10 questions about when their kids, take them home and ask them. So he gets home and he starts to ask his mom these questions. As he does, she says, oh, John, you know what? I can show you some of this stuff. She goes to the shelf, takes out this big book he's never seen before, her high school yearbook, and she starts to flip through and show him pictures of when she was a kid in school. And she does, she says, John, I forgot. I've been meaning to tell you, I went to school with your principal. Here's a picture of me, he was in 10th grade, in gym shorts. Kind of dorky looking, wasn't it? Well, John thinks this is hilarious. So next he goes to school and says to the kids, you guys won't believe it. I have a picture of Mr. Snatcher Girl, who's in 10th grade. The kids say you do not. He says, I do. They say you're full of bullies. He says, I prove it. I bring it in. So then he goes over and says, Mom? 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 Can I take the yearbook to school? His mother says, no. Are you kidding, John? That book doesn't leave this house. Don't you understand, honey? It's irreplaceable. They only make those ones. That's why it's called the yearbook. It was for that year. And that one was, well, let's check it. It was, Oh, Lord, John. It was 20 years ago. And watch how it's detailed. Correct the emotional volume of this book. Oh, honey, you have to understand. All my best friends signed this book. Gosh. Most of them have left town by now. Some I haven't seen since the day we graduated, and, two of the people who signed this book have died since then, John. Oh, honey, no. This book doesn't go to school. If anything happened to this book, it would break my heart. So that's the book he's going to drop in the book. What is he going to get? So he's to school without the book the first day. Now, I'm not going to tell you that writing is easy. I'm not here to lie to you. But I will tell you, when you get your scenes set up, the dialogue almost writes itself. You know what happens when he gets to school. His friends, in the tender, gentle, loving way of true friends all around the world, call him liar, liar, pants on fire. The girl he likes says, John, you're such a weebo. Ralph, the classmate, says, dude, you're so bogus about that book. He's going to be like, no, you silly for you tonight. Which he knows that Ralph will do. So that night before Ralph can catch him, he races home, locks himself in his house. He's safe, but only for the night, because he knows it's all going to start again the next morning. The teasing, the making fun, the noogies. He can't sleep. 3 o'clock in the morning, he's still wide awake, lying in bed, staring in the darkness, listening to the rain on the roof. Now, the rain on the roof is a detail, and it does two things. One, it helps you, the reader, feel as if you are inside the story with him, which is what you want when you're reading a story. You don't want to be inside your room. You want to be swept into the world of the story. And details of taste, touch, sight, sound, and smell are part of how writers do that. Two, it prepares your brain for the puddle the book's going to get dropped into the next day. Now, the truth is, I probably would not get the detail of the rainstorm until the third or fourth draft. The truth is, a lot of times when you're reading a story, reading a book, watching a movie, because remember, movies are written too, no writer in a movie, you get to the end and you say, that's so cool, how everything came together. At the end, what really happened was the writer got to the end, and I went back and put in the things that came together. That's how stories are made, not the first time through, the second, third, fourth, and more times through. Revising doesn't mean fixing the spelling. Revising means fixing the story, putting in the stuff that makes it work. Well, there he is, lying in bed, listening to the radio, just going, oh, man, I cannot believe I'm going to mess like this again. This kind of stuff always happens to me. Me. Always me. Well, this is Aunt Mom's fault. She is so fussy. She's so worried about that stupid book before. She never even stupid looks at it. I shouldn't even ask her. I could have taken it to school and Jimmy even known it was. I could take it to school and she wouldn't even know it had been gone. She never looks at it. She just worries too much. I'll take it, take care of it, bring it back, problem solved. And that's what he decides to do. The next morning he sneaks out of the house carrying his mother's book. Now he's doing a bad thing, but he's not a bad kid at heart. He thought they'd take very good care of the book. It's not his fault, detail that rained the night before. So his fault, detail, there are going to be puddles all over the place. And if you want to set the puddle in the reader's mind, don't just say it's there. Let a car drive through it and splice his leg so we feel it's there. It's not his fault, detail, that Ralph's father beat Ralph up that morning and Ralph is in a bad mood and wants to take it on somebody else, which is the way it goes. It's not his fault, though. He sees Ralph. He can't even go, hey, Ralph, I got the... Before he's lying face down the puddle. None of that's his fault. What is his fault? Is that his mother's beloved yearbook is underneath him in that puddle, sucking up muddy water. Kid drops a book in a puddle. That sentence is the entire story. The rest of it is the details we use to crank up the emotional volume. Now, at this point, writing a story, you play another game. Remember the first game I called Kid in Kindergarten? This game I call... or, how rotten can I make life for this character? What's the worst thing that could happen to John right now? A truck could run over him. But that would be the end of the story. It's a stupid ending because there's nothing to do with what's gone on so far. Who does he not want to see at this moment? Everybody?
Swan.
That's what you get. So you figure out what the character does not want and you throw it at him to see how he responds. There he is. Can I sit on this? Mm-hmm. Okay. There he is, lying in the puddle, taking with his mother, driving to sleep under the grocery store. She's tooling along in the SUV. She's playing the radio. She's playing music she won't let him listen to. She stops the car because she gets in the puddle. She rolls down the window. She leans out. Is she mad?
Yeah.
Not yet. You must always look through the character's eyes. She will respond to what she sees. Now look through her eyes. What she sees? Her kid in the puddle. As soon as you see what she sees, the story writes itself. The dialogue writes itself. You know what happens. Oh, John. Oh, honey. Baby pookie pie. Oh, come on, honey. Stand up. Get in the car. We'll take a minute to clean up. John? John, stand up. Stand up, John. Stand up right in front of your mother with the muddy, soggy, dripping yearbook she told you not to take out of the house because it would break her heart if they had to do it. Stand up. I'd rather be hanging by my fingertips. Let's make it worse. Here's the key to making a good story a great story. I do not always get this for myself, but when I do, I know I really nailed it. Make your character face a tough choice, a moral decision. Here's John's. He suddenly realizes the puddle is so deep, he can stand up, and his mother will not know the book is there. But if he does that, he must get in the car with her and drive off, leaving the book behind, where it will continue to soak up muddy water and be completely destroyed forever. But he's off the hook. He's off the hook. He's in no trouble. Or he can go to the puddle with the book. She'll be furious, but they can rush home, spread it out, dry it off. It's damaged, but not destroyed. Which will probably describe John by the end of the day, too. So what choice does he make? See the book in the puddle or take it out? Save the book or save his puddle? In, out, book, puddle. What's he do? I don't know. I never read that story. But you can see, you don't have to go on a cliff to have a tough situation. It still won't work if you don't care about the character. That was the problem with my little story, Monster for Day. He didn't care about the character. I wrote the story, I can't tell you his name was, because he had no personality. Now, I have not yet figured out that was the problem. I just knew the story didn't work. Well, when you want to be a writer and you write a story and it doesn't work, you have a problem. When you have a problem, what do? You think about it. The way I thought about it was by not thinking about it. Which doesn't make any sense until you think about it. Let me see if I can explain that to you. How many of you, and the question goes for the grown-ups in the room too, how many of you have dreams at night? Raise your hand if you have dreams at night. If you don't have your hand up being shy, we all dream every night. You too, come on. Let's get the program. Put your hands back down. You're just telling me something you may not... You gotta be with the kids. You gotta be with the kids, man. You just told me something you may not have realized about yourselves. You all do every night, automatically and naturally, what I do for a living. You tell stories. You go in your own room, or whatever's asleep, lie down in your bed, you close your eyes, and you tell yourself stories all night long. Because that's all a dream is a story. That one part of your brain is telling another part of your brain. If you've ever had a dream, even once, you have proved you are a natural born storyteller. I've had a good dream, the dream is interesting, exciting, funny, scary, but my past has never been so good as it hasn't. And I haven't lost my past yet. You are a good storyteller. Now learn to get it out of your head and onto paper, something else too, but you're all storytellers. Don't ever say, I can't think of a story, because you do it every night of your life. Now, the part of your brain that does the dreaming is really quite wonderful. This is your brain. Not much in there, is there? Actually, there's a lot in there, so we're going to talk about it in a second. But pretend, go with me for a second. If this was your brain, so sideways, if this was your brain, you draw a line up here, you could say, that's all it takes to run these wire works, smallest part of the brain. It's not physically on top of that, sort of located in different parts, but it takes about 10% to run these. Scientists have a big name for it, they call it the conscious mind. Underneath this much bigger part, in terms of being under its control, scientists call the un, which means not, or the sub, which means under the subconscious mind. I call it the dream brain, because it's where your dreams come from. Now this part's in charge of your awake. As you begin to drift off the sleep, this division between them starts to fade, this part starts to take over. The two most creative times of day, as you're drifting off the sleep and coming out of sleep, because the two parts of the brain are more closely connected. This part rests, this part works 24 hours a day. How do we know it works 24/7? Because if it stops, you're gone. The scientific, technical definition of dead is not when your heart stops beating, because then you start beating sometimes. It's not when you stop breathing. The scientific definition of dead is no brain activity. You're either dead or watching television. Now, if this is working 24 hours a day, what's it doing right now while this part's in charge? Oh, two or three things. One, it's solving problems, which we're going to talk about in a second. Tubes running your body, it makes your heart beat, your lungs pump, your digestive system, you don't think about that, it just does it for you. And three, it's sucking up information, it's like a giant sponge for experience. Everything you've ever seen, heard, felt, smelled, tasted, touched, experienced in any way is passed away down there. Now, if you're using the waking part of your brain to make sense of what I say, which I will admit is not always easy given how fast I talk, you may be saying to yourself, that poor man has lost his mind. Because if everything I ever saw or heard was in my head, I would be a perfect student and never fail a test. Right? Wrong. It's not that it's not in here. It's that you can't get that here as soon as you want it. You know this is true because it happens to you all the time. Let me give you an example. Put this down to every kid in this room, one form or another, every adult, too, for that matter. You come home from school. Come flying through the door and say, hey, Ma! But your mother's on the phone. She says, just a minute, dear. But you're in a hurry, so you go, no, Ma, Ma, Ma! She says, just a minute. Dear, you go,
Ma. Ma.
To drive out of her mind. She finally goes, Mrs. Smith, can I call you back for a second? I have a small problem I need to take care of. I go back, I promise. She hangs the phone. She turns to her small problem, namely you, and she says, all right, I'm off the phone. What was so all fired and important? And you make this brilliant response. You say, classroom, and there was Russell. That's his name in the book. That's his name in real life. Russell was a great kid and loved Russell. He was bright, he was funny, he was creative, he was imaginative. He was the biggest weenie you ever met in your life. Everybody pushed Russell around. His mother pushed him around, his father pushed him around, the kids pushed him around, I pushed him around. Not because I wanted to push him around, but if I said, Russell, go, I thought, here's a kid who needs a chance to be a monster. She did something very rude. I don't do as much anymore. Not much. I took Russell's personality, lock, stock, barrel, and first name, I put him in the story. I said, what would this kid, who I know so well, do if he could turn into a monster? And I wrote the story over again. And this time it wasn't 5 pages long, it was 150 pages long. So you can see there was a big difference between the first version, not the first draft, the first version, Monster for Day, and the second version, same basic idea, kid becomes a monster, but now I've got this long, stressed out story. Now, strangely in my scene, Russell's not the only thing in the book that's based on real life. Strangely in my scene, most of this weird book about a kid who turns into a monster is based on real life. To explain that, I want to start by giving you some bad advice. The reason I'm going to give you some bad advice is you're going to get this advice a lot as you go over high school and college, and people are going to tell you this bad advice. I want to inoculate you against it. People can tell you over and over again, you should only write about what you know. Well, my book's about unicorns, dragons, monsters, giants, and teachers who are secretly aliens. And if I only wrote what I knew, I could not have written any of those except maybe the one about the teachers who are secretly aliens. What I don't know, I can learn. That's what the library's for. I'm in the library all the time, learning new stuff to put the stories. Write what you know makes sense when you understand it this way. Write what you care about, what matters to you, what is in your heart and in your guts is the only good work you'll ever do. When you teach, it fills your life. I was teaching every day, it poured right through me in the book. Here's what's real in the Monster's Ring. Russell, real life kid. Russell's mother, based on Russell's real life mother. I figured she was the reason he was the way he was. You had to see her in action. Russell's father I never met. I gave him a problem I didn't know about. He talks too much, based on me. Russell's teacher, based on me. The weird stuff she did in your class, my class. The school, my school. Wetzel Road Elementary in Liverpool, New York. It's geography, it's Halloween customs. I just picked him up and put him in the story. If I've been teaching here in New York City, the story would have taken place here in New York City. I just used what was around me. The bully, Eddie. Man, did I know Eddie. We'll come in for landing in about 5 more minutes. Eddie's real name was Stephen. First time I met him was in first grade because I came to that school as a student teacher at the first grade level and working. They hired me in that same year in January to teach second grade. When Stephen got the second grade, 2 or 3 years later, I had him again. Next year, into third grade, they came back to me for a special reading program. I had him again. Next year, I moved to fourth grade and Stephen got there too. I had him again. We knew each other very well. Stephen was not a bad kid. I was quite fond of him. They got in trouble a lot. Mostly because they pushed him around the home. They came to school and pushed kids around, which is the way usually goes. But at least he got in trouble in interesting ways. Here's a typical Stephen story. Cold, rotten, snowy day, like we've hit here in the Northeast, especially in Syracuse, the snowiest city of over 100,000 people in the world. Do riding outside in your recess. I've got my class, my teaching partner's class, 50 kids running there, I'm having a good time. 5 kids come trotting up to me, and they go, Mr. Cole, Mr. Cole. Stephen flushed a banana down the toilet, so I'll plug up. I said, Stephen, get over here! Now, these are 2 words he was used to hearing, because I said it 3 or 4 times a day. Stephen, get over here! He's running over, he stood in front of me, his belts are like a fire, like he had a face like a full moon with a crew cut on top. He looked up and said, this is a direct quote. Yeah! I said, Steve, did you flush a banana down the toilet? You know what he said? Yeah! You know what I said? What for? You know what he said? I don't know. Let's see what happened. Was what life was Stephen was like. How can you not use a kid like that? The book I've used him in 5. Now you see the monster and the bully, Eddie, the Monster's Ring. He is Duncan Dougal in all 4 books that my teacher's and alien series. If you read any of those, Duncan Dougal is based on this kid also. There's more in the book that's based on real life, even some of the weird stuff. For example, there's a scene where Russell causes the first riot in the history of Boardman Road at Lumbridge School. It happens like this. He's trying to fit the bee following. His friends have great plans. One friend is going to be a pirate, one friend is going to paint his face purple and be an alien, and one friend is going to fill his mouth with mayonnaise and run around pretending he is a pimple. It's based on real life. I knew it was going to be good. Russell's trying to fit the bee and he realizes, I don't need a costume, I got the ring, because he's learned to jump back and forth from monster to human. So the day of the party, he comes to school with a bag full of old clothes. It's time for the party, he goes in the bathroom, puts on the old clothes, twists the ring, sets the chant, pow, bang, instant monster. It is the greatest costume in the history of Halloween. He did not just dress up like a monster, he became a monster. He's the essence of Halloween, he's Mr. Halloween. Unfortunately, as a monster, he has no self-control. Halloween, end of the day, time for the party. Kids have all had too much candy to eat, none sugar highs. They have no self-control either. He ends up the entire student body chasing him up and down the halls of the school, and he jumps the principal as he makes a break for freedom. It's based on real life. When I taught second grade, and when I taught fourth grade, I told my kids, a half-mad twin brother named Igor. Igor lived, I told the kids, in the cellar, under the cellar, under the cellar, under the house, four cellars down, and we only let Igor out one day of the year, his birthday, Halloween. Now, my twin brother could have been born 6 months apart from me, we weren't sure, but there are things about Igor that man was not meant to know. The kids loved Igor because he was so bad. He was rude, loud, they thought he was hoops. So starting September, the kids would come to me and they'd say, get your coffee, get your coffee. Can Igor be here for the party? I'd say, no, I'm spent too bad at home. They'd say, oh, please. I said, no, last time he snuck up in the cellar, chased me around the house, tried to give me a black eye, I don't want him. They'd say, oh, please, please. I'd say, no. They'd say, please. I'd say, no, this is going all of September, most of October, please. I'd say, no. They'd say, please. I'd say, no. They'd say, oh, please. I'd say, no. But they keep bugging me. Finally, I say, you guys can understand. He is so bad, so nice, so disgusting. I cannot stand to have him around. It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. I know he's my twin brother, but it embarrasses me. If he is here, I am out of here. They'd say, okay. I'd say, all right, he'll be here. Day of the party, I'd leave the room, and a few minutes later, Igor would come to the door. Now, he looked just like me. He was my twin brother, after all, except he had a bald head. I didn't used to. He had dark circles under his eyes. I didn't used to. He had dark lines, deep lines, that's in his face. I didn't used to. And a waist-length black beard. I still don't. He wore a fur coat that covered the hump on his shoulder. One foot kind of dragged behind him as he walked. And Igor always carried a teddy bear. And Igor hit him all the time and it was a bear. Bop, bop, bop. Kids loved to get hit with Igor's bear. It was like a Halloween in my town. So all the teachers come around and go, Igor, Igor, come on, come on. Igor came running through the door. He jumped up on top of a desk and he go, heads up, kiddies. Here's Igor. Whack, 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 whack. Occasionally, the children would get excited. Sometimes they'd try to steal Igor's bear. More than once, Igor ended up with an entire fifth grade class chasing down the hall because they were scarier than he was. So when Russell's being chased around with an entire student body, it's only a slight exaggeration, but actually happened. Honestly, that all happened in my class. I'll let you figure out where Igor really came from. I will tell you that Igor has not been seen for 10 years, but on Halloween night this year, I don't know why, but we had an Igor eruption at the house. He was out standing in front of the house on the porch railing, yelling out the kids, candy goodies! We had so much fun with Igor, because the kids would talk about him all year long. They would write notes home. He'd write notes back, love Igor. They would do Igor math problems. So I finally wrote a whole book about Igor. If you see the book Goblins in the Castle, that's where Igor came from. So you know that Russell's a real kid in Monster's Ring. Eddie's a real kid. He's Duncan Doolin in my teacher's name in books. And Igor even came from something sort of weirdly real in my life. There's more than what this based on real life. Part of it's about is the fact that I was a monster in my life. Well, I didn't have horns and fangs, but I had a bad temper. Not a real sweetie most of the time. But I am! Oh, excuse me. See, every time that temper can burst out briefly, transform me into something very frightening to the people around me, frightening to me. I was trying to get my temper under control. Russell needed to find the power of his temper, so he sent to Eddie Steve and said, no, you may not keep me like that any longer. You must show me some respect. But he let that go too far. He'd become a monster, as I usually did. So at the secret level, every good book has got a secret level. This story is really about trying to find out how to use your own personal power, not letting it turn you into a monster. And the only reason I tell you that is I'm not going to tell you a secret about it, so I'm not going to tell you. I had no idea that story was about the years after I learned. It was a new thing from the heart, from the gut. Just let flow. All of you know what's really coming out 2 years later. But then the monster story moved from being a 5-page story called Monster Per Day to a 150-page story, at which point it was called Monster Pills. I squeezed it down to about 100 pages when I made the Monster's Ring. There's 100 more things I can tell you, but we don't have 100 minutes left. So I'll tell you this. When I finally got a letter, didn't say no, didn't say maybe, didn't say, dude, your baby's ugly. I said, yeah, they want to publish this book. I could not hold still. I ran outside, I jumped up and down, I ran in circles, I sang, I danced, I laughed, I looked like a total maniac. Hey, maniacs are people too. Because when you've been trying to do something for 6, 7, 8 years and it finally comes true, there's no way you can hold still because nothing feels better than having a dream come true. Because dreams are the essence of life. And you may not realize it, but right now, you're building the shape of your life with the dreams you build for yourself. Here's the last story, 1 minute. Tattered clothes all fluttering, worn out voice still muttering, ragged John comes knocking at all the doors in town. And when a door swings open, then you can hear the hope in the thin, cracked voice that wonders if you've seen his unicorn. We all know John is crazy and his mind has gone all hazy. And the only thing we really wish is he just would let us be. But John, he keeps on questing. The poor man knows no resting. For there's something hurt inside him. And the pain won't go away. I've heard when John was younger, he was taken with a hunger to see that white horned wonder they call the unicorn. But when that star horned, moon maned dancer finally called, John could not answer. Fear held him like a prisoner, and he watched it walk away. So now, empty eyed, John hobbles across the village cobbles, and the only fear he feels is that it will never come again. But when I see old ragged John go staggering by and wandering on, I know there's nothing sadder than a heart that feared its dream. If a unicorn should call to you some moon-mad night all washed in dew, then here's the prayer to whisper. Grant me the heart to follow. The dreams you build for yourself right now are going to determine the life that you're going to have as time goes on. And the better the dreams, the better the lives. And the way you get good dreams is to put good stuff in here to begin with. So that's my wish for you. Good stuff in, great dreams, and the chance and the courage to make them all come true. I promised you a chance for some questions, so I did not want to break that promise. I know we're just about out of time, but I did promise you a chance. Yes, right there.
Can you tell us a little bit how you started Fullcast Audio?
Why? Sure. I have a whole 45-minute speech on that, but I'll just tell you that. Okay. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Is she going to have a book signed?
Yes.
Is she going to have a book? Yes?
Okay.
Any minute, Raphael, I have to answer this question first. A very condensed version. When my daughter was 14, she and I made a cross-country trip. I said, we'll get in the car, we'll point it west, we'll drive till we run into an ocean, then we'll turn around and drive back. She was 14, so I knew I was going to be stuck in a small moving space for 6 weeks with a crazy person. And before we left, we went to the library and took out several unabridged audiobooks. And I fell in love with them. I learned two things. One, that when you're driving to Kansas, Pride and Prejudice is riveting. And two, a shared listening is unlike any other way of sharing literary experience. When you read to the child reads to you, you're in charge, or whoever reads is in charge. When you do a parallel read where you both read the same book, you get out of sync with each other, and somebody can sneak ahead, somebody can look at the ending. When you're listening to the audiobook together, nobody knows what's going to happen. You share the experience, and you live through it together. Well, I fell in love with the form, and I said to an audiobook company that I saw at an ALA, you should do some of my books. They said, sure. And because I liked to perform, I auditioned to read The Monster's Ring, actually. But their house style is very slow, with spaces between words and long gaps at the periods. Like that. Which is, you know already, is not my mode of speech. Now, I mean, I slowed down my regular microphone, but it was faster than they like. Well, they did two books. One I loved, the other I did not like. It was The Monster's Ring because they said Mr. Keenan's name wrong. They never even asked me how to say it. And that's very important to me. So I said to myself, I'll do it myself next time. Listening Library contacted me and wanted to do one of my books. I said I'd do it myself. And began a conversation that led to the idea, and Tim Ditlow from Listening Library swears it was my idea, I swear it was his idea, to record books with a full cast rather than a single reader. And we started experimenting with the form. We started a separate business to do that. After Random House bought his company, I was on my own. They decided they didn't want to do that because it cost a lot more to do them that way, and you only do it that way because you're stupid, you know, like me. Because to me, the art is more important than, I'd like to make a profit, but to me, it's a great artistic way to do things. So after a couple of years, I started my own company. We've done 70 books now, Next week, we go in the studio with Graceling, which has had a big review in the New York Times this weekend. We record Paula Danziger, Sid Fleischman, James Howe, Tamara Pierce, me, God, who did the Book of Job. That was like he was our biggest name author. And I love it. I think it brings together everything I love. Performance, reading aloud, children's literature, family experience, working with a bunch of people that I love. I just love doing it.
What's it called? Forecast?
Full cast. That's because we use a full cast.
F-U-L-L.
And the website is www.fullcastaudio.com. And so I've been doing it for between the two companies about 15 years now. And I love the work. I love the sound we get. I just listened to our news recording as I drove down here today. The time flies. Our motto is, we put more actors in every box. And, you know, we do think of ourselves as the secret to peace in the family kind.
Can we download them?
They're virtually all the titles are available on audible.com.
Okay.
Yes, you can download from there. The pricing is good from Audible because they don't have a physical product to mess around with. Audible's search function doesn't always work well. Like, if you search on full cast, you get a whole lot of stuff that's not ours, but they recorded with a full cast. So your best bet, if you want to download it, to see what titles you have, we can go to our website, fullcastaudio.com, see what the titles are, and then go over to audible.com to download it. Raphael.
Is Monsters Ring your first book?
It was my first novel-length book. I'd done two picture books before that, The Foolish Giant and Sarah's Unicorn. But The Monsters Ring was the first book for older readers. Now, what I did not tell you about that is the book is 25 years old now, and for its 20th anniversary, and you got the 20th anniversary edition, I rewrote it and expanded it, put back in some of the stuff I cut out for the earlier edition. So that's the expanded, improved version. That's available from Full Cast Audio. I read the narration. And one of the things that we're most proud of is that we use kids as kids in our acting troupe. So the part of Russell was played by a 12-year-old boy, 10-year-old boy. I can't remember exactly how old he was right now. Something we've done from the beginning. You can't do it in regular audiobooks because it's very hard for a kid to carry the whole book all by themselves. Edward Asner calls audiobooks the Olympics of acting. But because we work in an ensemble fashion, we use kids as kids. And the credibility of that sound, as opposed to an adult trying to sound like a 12-year-old girl when there's an adult male reading all story, makes a much more engaging sound. Emily.
I know that TV is sort of the future, there's sometimes really good stories, and people have written the stories and drawn them and worked really hard on them, the same way storytellers have worked really hard on their books. The difference is, you watch them. But storytellers, they deserve to be read, and TV shows, they're made to be watched, and they don't have sometimes good stories.
Oh, there's sometimes excellent stories. But your point about they're made to be watched, you watch them, is one of the things that I would not say never watch TV, really. But the thing is, when you read or when you listen to an audiobook, you do the half the work in your head. Watching television is exactly, as you said, you're watching, so it's passive. They've done all the work for you. So you can't be imaginatively engaged in the same way. The other problem with television is it is quite literally addictive. It draws you in and you have a hard time. People sit down in front of the TV and they have a hard time getting up again. So it's not that there's a problem watching one show, it's the problem that when people sit down and watch 5 hours in a row, which is what happens to a lot of people. And here's one more thing to think about with television. When you watch television with commercials, do you know what the product is? Do you know what's being sold? When you watch commercial television, do you know what's being sold? You might think they're selling cereal, or sneakers, or deodorant, or whatever is being advertised. What's really been sold is space in your brain. That's what the advertiser pays the television company. The television company says, for your money, I'm going to get you inside people's heads. Television's product is space in your brain. They're making money off someone's space in your brain, and you don't get a cut of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Alice.
Why did you start writing?
Why did I start writing?
Yes.
I wanted a job. I wouldn't have to wear a tie to go to work. Now look at me.
No.
No, actually, I started writing because I love books very, very much. And I wanted to make the thing I loved. You know, it's. Some people love something they don't feel compulsion to make it, but I love books, and when I read a book when I was a kid, it would make me laugh, it would make me cry, make me They read Mind Shivering with Fear, which I thought was kind of cool. I think I want to do that. I want to make books that will make other people feel the way that book made me feel. Yes, back there.
Did you ever write a book for your class?
For my class?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Monster's Dream, I read it to my class as I was working on it. Goblins in the Castle, which is the book featuring Igor, I really wrote for my class. It's a published book, but I wrote for them. There's a book called The Dragon Slayers that first existed as a musical play that I wrote for my fourth graders to perform. And then I took the script and turned it into a book later on. So yeah, my class was very much in my mind when I was writing. Yes?
Two questions, two parts. Do you still teach, and do you talk this fast to your fourth graders?
I do not still teach. I miss it. I've